Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. A lot of people give sex advice, but not so many people can give sex advice and call themselves scientists as well. Emily Nagoski, author of the book Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life, is here to give us some factual evidence about the most important topics. Including attraction, arousal, and sexual desire. How come there is Viagra for men, but no libido pill for women? And how come genital arousal isn't the same as actual sexual desire? And why do a lot of women desire sex from abusive men? All of these questions and so much more aren't just meant for interesting conversation, but can take our sex lives to a much higher ground. It's time to put sex in context and take control of our sexuality. Emily, welcome to our show. First of all, again, welcome to Gluck Radio. Welcome to the show. You're talking about something that, unfortunately or fortunately, everyone talks about. Very few people do it, but it's about sex. So one of the things that for me, one of the reasons why I love the book and I love the way you came across in it, is that you really wanted to integrate it with science as well, as opposed to just opinion. Now, often science is just opinion, but yours, I felt really, you had a lot of good stuff in there. I want to ask the first question. Is there any such thing as normal in sex?
Well, it's either that everything is normal or else nothing is normal. Because how do you tell? So for me, my definition, the one that I use as a sex educator, is it's normal sex if it's full consent of everyone involved and satisfaction with no unwanted pain.
Okay, and see, now I would say that I would have a different definition. Okay, I would say that normal is the norm. Now, that could be just very boring, as in, for the most of the time, if you start kissing, it's normally on the mouth. If someone's starting the kiss and they start sucking on the toes, it's really okay and it's great and it's fun, but it wouldn't probably be the norm. So it's not abnormal, but it's simply not the norm, that, unless we're using different words.
So there's the statistical meaning of normal, which is it fits within the 95th percentile in the peak of the bell curve, is statistically normal, in which case literally 95% of us are normal. And then there's the sort of like psychological diagnostic sense of normal, like this is the category that's healthy and normal, and this is the category of what's diseased and abnormal.
Okay, I love that. Okay, because normal is usually boring.
Yeah. Normal means ordinary. And does anybody want to be sexually ordinary?
Exactly. All normal is kind of a little bit boring. So let me ask you this question. How many percentage of women actually have orgasm during the process of being intimate?
Overall, somewhere between 90% and 98% of women have orgasms.
Okay. Have orgasms. Right? Okay, that's great.
Have orgasms. 30% of women, 25% to 30% of women, are reliably orgasmic from penetration all by itself.
Ah.
The remaining 70% are sometimes orgasmic with penetration, rarely or never orgasmic with penetration. But just because you don't have orgasms from that one kind of stimulation doesn't mean you can't have orgasms lots of other kinds of ways.
Actually, that's really interesting because I thought the number was lower. I thought that only 5 to 10% of women actually reached orgasm during penetration. I'm glad to hear that it's 30%. Okay. So the others are reaching orgasm through oral sex or just different types of experience, correct?
Mostly through clitoral stimulation, yep.
Right. Great. So, question, from a scientific point of view, how can one enhance not only the experience, not only the orgasm, but just the entire, you know, the entire comfort level and fun level of the sexual intimate experience?
Oh, there are so many ways to make it better. First of all, as a culture, we have this really active conversation about how much sex we want, like how much we desire sex and how much sex we're having, how frequently or not. And there's this sort of silence around how much we enjoy the sex we're having. So I think the most efficient strategy for improving the quality of your sexual connection is to think about what kind of sex you enjoy having, what kind of sex is worth all the effort and the time and the cleanup afterward. Like, what kind of sex is it that you really like to have?
I hate when women jump up and clean up. I mean, why don't they just stay there and hug and relax? And what, you know, what's this shower thing? But let me ask you this question.
But that's a real thing.
I mean, no, it is a real thing. But I also think that what happens is from my perspective, if you're really being intimate with someone you really care about, you know, part of it is play, is being dirty, is playing in the mud, is
Absolutely.
Getting as sloppy and as dirty and as nasty as you can get.
Oh,
and why clean
yeah.
up? Just enjoy the mess.
Because the cultural messages that we get are exactly the opposite of that.
Fuck the cultural messages.
Error!
No, I completely agree. And when two people get in, or however many, get in bed together, in reality, they're allowed to do anything they want that they're both interested in doing. Like, I have a friend who fucked his girlfriend's armpit because he could. Because you're allowed to do anything you want to. And it's really hard when two people get in bed to close the door and actually block out the culture that we were that you're trying not to bring to bed with you. It's really hard not to bring the cultural messages about sexual shame and about body self-criticism. It takes practice to let that stuff go and leave it outside.
You know what? You're 100% right. And here's what it takes. It takes the ability to see yourself not as an extension of both parental or societal norms, but, you know, who, you know, what is it that you really believe, your personal identity, the fact that there's a sanctity about that you have a right to experience pleasure on any level you want to, as long as it's consensual and it's there's no danger involved to either party. But breaking away from cultural norms are difficult because cultural norms they're embedded in society as a way of creating structure, just the way you have religious norms. And one of the things that you brought up, which I thought was really brilliant, is that, you know, we teach kids sex is bad, sex is bad, sex is bad, and then they get to the age where they're going to have sex and they know nothing about it. They bring shame. You know, sometimes they get married early and it's always a divorce because they don't have the comfort in being comfortable with sex. So I'm going to throw this out to you, Emily. When should a child or person be talked to about sex? What should the conversation be? And how should they, in a healthy way, be grafted into a normal sexual life?
I think there is no such thing as too early to start talking to kids about sex in an age-appropriate way. And what counts as age-appropriate will vary from child to child. And mostly it's about answering the questions that they ask with as much information as they actually need. But I think what makes it as difficult for parents to talk to their kids about sex and raise them to be sex positive, healthy people is how the parent feels about their own sexuality. Like, if your child asks you a question about sex and how you feel about your own sexuality and sex in general is uncertain or shameful or uncomfortable, then what your child is going to receive is that emotional experience that you're having of shame and discomfort. And they're going to learn to associate that with sexuality. So the best thing a parent can do is not so much worry about which words you choose when you answer your kids' questions, but how do you feel about your own sexuality, so that when you get asked about it, which you will, what you feel is positive and comfortable and the way you want your kid to feel about their own bodies when they grow up.
Now, great answer. So let me ask you a question. What did your parents tell you about sex?
Absolutely nothing. We had medical encyclopedias in our house.
Yeah. And John, what did your parents tell you about sex?
Very, very little. Very, very little.
Yeah, so I came from a liberal Jewish house, you know, 12 years old. the parents bring out condoms and they say, listen, use this, you know, this may, you know, get anyone pregnant, have a good time, and, you know, anything's good between consenting, you know, people. You know, having said that, it is a cultural thing. It's completely cultural. And how did you, not knowing much from your parents, how did you develop a healthy sexual self?
Very carefully. I started getting trained as a sex educator in my first semester in college, which happened to be the same semester that I started my first sexual relationship. And I come from a pretty dysfunctional family of origin. So inevitably, my first sexual relationship was also pretty dysfunctional. And one of the things that I say as a joke is that I made all the mistakes so that nobody else has to.
And just for the record, there are four normal families in the United States. Okay, they don't speak to each other and they live in different states. Because there's not too many. When we say dysfunctional, that is the norm. You know, most of the time, what happens is people get together for all the wrong reasons. You know. All kidding aside, I'm an executive life coach. I do medical hypnosis, been doing it for 40 years. People don't have a clue of why they're with the person they're with. So often, it's just because they didn't have the balls to say no.
So the way I get asked about this a lot on a regular basis, about like, why do we fall for the people we fall to, or why do we get into these relationships, especially by college students who are new to the falling in love thing. And the way I talk about it is, in the first 4 years of your life, your parents inadvertently teach you what it feels like to receive love. And they teach you what a relationship looks like. And it's like they're shaping the bell that is going to be rung. So you get into adolescence and you meet somebody who rings that bell. And if in the first 4 years of your life, you're having your bell shaped by a really healthy, happy example, great. Then the people who ring your bell are going to be a healthy, happy match for you.
Exactly. And that is why there are no healthy, happy matches, because most parents are dysfunctional. You know, and that's why we love your book, because at least a person can stand by and say, you know what? Okay, my parents are dysfunctional. Now let's go on with our life. Let's make it happen.
As an adult, to notice that the people who are ringing your bell are recreating your family of origin, and you don't want that, you can begin intentionally to reshape your bell so that you find yourself attracted to people who are better for you and create the kind of life that you really want to have.
I love it, Emily. What are some surprises you could tell our listening audience about the clitoris and vagina that most people don't know and most women don't know?
Well, for one thing, the size of the clitoris is way bigger than we generally think of it. Most people, when they envision the clitoris, it's this little nub right at the top of the vulva. And that's part of it. That's actually the female equivalent of the head of the penis. But as we all know, the head of the penis is not the whole penis. There's the whole shaft. And in fact, the shaft extends deep inside the body. The same thing is true for the clitoris. There's this deep internal structure of the legs of the clitoris and the bulbs of the vestibule, which extend deep inside the body all the way down to the mouth of the vagina. So the clitoris actually sort of is everywhere. I call it the hokey pokey. It's what it's all about.
Oh, you know, excellent bit of information. So if you were giving some sexual guidance to a guy and you were saying, you really want to satisfy your partner, what would you tell him he should do differently than just, you know, concentrate on the head?
The main thing is to recognize that the clitoris is not. So there's a feminist porn star named Nina Hartley, and her saying is, the clitoris is not a doorbell. I actually had a student come and declare to me that she felt that her clitoris was broken because there were times when her partner could touch it and she didn't experience pleasure. And I asked her about sort of what the context was where that was happening. And they were skipping over all other foreplay and assuming they could just go directly to the clitoris and have it feel good. And the thing is, you have to create a context. You have to preheat the oven, basically. You have to create a state of mind where the sensation of clitoral stimulation is going to feel sensual and erotic because she's in a sensual and erotic state of mind. Once you're there, once there's a whole lot of warming up, you can stimulate the clitoris through one of the hypotheses for what vaginal, why some women do have orgasms from vaginal stimulation is because they're actually stimulating the internal structures of the clitoris through the vaginal walls.
I always thought it was the portfolio stock that you showed them that did that, but this is a different theory. Okay. I'm kidding. I actually like yours better. Talk to me about the vagina.
So one of the things that I was surprised about a few years ago, I was teaching at Smith for the first time, and a student raised her hand during my anatomy lecture and said, "What's the evolutionary origin of the hymen?" And I had never even considered that question. So I went and I looked it up. And in that process, well, the evolutionary origin of the hymen is that it's a byproduct. It's a spandrel. It's a leftover. It has no biological function, no reproductive function. But I also found out that everything that I had been taught early in my training about the hymen was wrong. So first of all, it turns out the hymen doesn't break. Or if it does, it heals. It can bruise, but again, it heals. It's one of the least likely causes of pain with intercourse, even early on. Not everybody has a hymen, and there's at least 5 different kinds of hymen a woman might have if she has one. So we sort of, everything we think about the hymen is wrong.
Isn't science wonderful because it reinvents itself every year? Just yesterday, it was last week. You know, they came out and they said the size of our galaxy is twice as big as what they thought it was. And this is something that we must really remember that science is also always evolving, and it doesn't mean it's completely accurate. But the one thing that is true is that you always have to continue to learn and explore and experience. So one of the things that I suggest about anyone who wants to have good sex is to have a good sense of self. And to realize that you're really okay the way you are. You don't have to have a perfect body to have amazing sex. You do have to have a really good attitude.
Mm-hmm. My mantra over and over is confidence and joy, confidence and joy. And for me, so...
See, I knew I liked you.
Someone asked me, what do you mean by confidence and what do you mean by joy? And I thought about it really carefully, and I decided that what confidence is knowing what's true about your body. So that's understanding the structure of your anatomy and the way your brain responds to sexual stimulation and what works for you for orgasm. That's knowing what's true is confidence.
And joy, and joy is the threesome.
Joy. Okay. Once you know
so what's joy? True, what's joy?
Joy is loving what's true about your body, because you may find that you are not a person who have orgasms from vaginal stimulation, but you do from clitoral stimulation. And we're raised in a culture that tells us if you're not having orgasms with penetration, then you're not fully functional. And that's wrong. And letting go of that.
And Emily, I want to add something, and I want your opinion because I respect your opinion, and I like the way you think. What is wrong with just being intimate with someone who you really care about, fooling around, doing whatever you want to do, having a lot of play? Who cares if there's an orgasm or not? Why are we so orgasm oriented? Meaning, do we really have to keep a record? Did you come? Did you come? What's wrong with just simply enjoying the love, the intimacy, the playfulness, the sloppiness of being with another person you care about?
Oh, I'm totally on your side. One of my top 3 sex tips is it's not about orgasm. It's about pleasure. And if you're enjoying yourself, then you're doing it right. And in fact, having the goal of orgasm can get in the way of having an orgasm.
I completely agree.
Because that self-monitoring of like, I'm getting to a high level of arousal. I might have an orgasm. I might not have an orgasm. What if I do? What if I don't? That noise is all hitting the brakes. And if you can release that and not have it be goal-oriented, but just have it be about enjoying yourself, then there is no such thing as failure. But we're a species that really likes to have goals. I compare, so a man who has a woman for a partner will often treat her orgasm like that when you go to the county fair, there's a strength tester where you hit the thing and the thing goes up and hits the bell, ding, and that means you're a man.
Right, but see, from my perspective, he is a man, you know, who's 150,000 years old, you know, and his Homo sapien brain isn't really fully formed. Because at the end of the day, it's I agree, it's simply not about that. And I don't know if it's about a goal or about a fear that you're not a real man if you can't get this girl off.
Oh, absolutely. I was talking to a sex therapist a couple of weeks ago who told me that I was suggesting that body self-criticism is the really big issue for most women. And he said that performance is the really big issue for most men. The idea of proving your masculinity and being a worthwhile sexual person by getting your partner off, which is, and if, you know, a couple gets together and she's just had a really long, hard, exhausting day and doesn't have the energy for it, and his sense of identity depends on making her have an orgasm, what is she going to do in that instance? Is she going to say, you know what, honey, it's not there for me today, but you're an awesome human being? She might, or she might just fake it.
She might just fake it.
For his ego.
What was the best sex that you ever had in your whole life? Was it with someone who you were intimate with, or is it someone who was more of a stranger?
Oh, the context that works for me absolutely is someone whom I know really well.
You know, I completely agree. I think, you know, again, this is, you know, Dr. G. I think that the emotional intimacy just completely is necessary for me, you know, to add to what sexual intimacy could bring. And sensual and sexual intimacy, I think, are two separate and very important parts. Because like you said, it doesn't have to be orgasm-centered. It could be centered on so many different playful things. But you're right. I think that what happens is when two people just hook up just to have sex, and doing what I do for almost 40 years, I will tell you that almost everyone leaves unsatisfied the next day.
So my tickling analogy here, I think, is relevant. You know how if you're in a good, sexy state of mind and your certain special someone starts tickling you, that can feel fun and playful and potentially lead to nookie, right? But if that exact same certain special someone starts tickling you when you are pissed off and frustrated and annoyed with them, how does the tickling feel?
Horrible. And if you're dating an Italian and they're tickling you and you like them, it could lead to nookie.
Right. So even though it's exactly the same sensation, the tickling sensation, because the context, your state of mind is different, the perception of the sensation is totally different. So what counts as pleasure depends on the context. That's the external circumstances and the internal mental state in which you experience that sensation. And for some people, sex with people they don't know really creates an intense, great context. But for a lot of people, so for example, 10% of college-age women have an orgasm the first time they have sex with a new partner. And for almost all of them, it's because they touched their own clitorises. Whereas more than 65% of women have an orgasm with their partner 6 months into a sexual relationship. We're much more likely to be orgasmic and enjoy sexual pleasure with a partner whom our bodies are familiar with.
So why do you think, and again, I agree with you. I think you're the person I've agreed with most since I've started this, you know, so many years ago. It's pretty interesting.
That's thrilling.
Emily, let me ask you a question. Why do so many people, after years of marriage, all of a sudden they stop having sex and you know, it's just not happening anymore? Now, I'm going to tell you what I think, but I want to hear what you think first.
Oh, okay. I think it doesn't happen all of a sudden. I think it happens gradually.
It does happen gradually. But it does happen.
As relationships change, you may have kids, your bodies will change, the structure of your relationship changes. Context really matters, and the context is changing over the course of a relationship. And one of the pieces of context is our beliefs and expectations around desire. We are generally told this story that the way desire is supposed to work is it should be spontaneous and out of the blue. You're just walking down the street or having lunch and you have this internal urge of like, I'd really like to go get me some sex. How about some sex? And that's one of the ways that people experience desire. But another way we experience desire is responsive desire, where you're not thinking about it. You don't feel that internal urge, but your partner starts caressing your arm or kissing your neck and your body goes, oh, that's a good idea. We should totally have some sex. And that's a normal way to experience desire, but it's not the spontaneous out of the blue. And the longer your relationship gets, that often creates a context where you experience desire as more responsive than spontaneous. But because we don't know that responsive desire is normal, we think that because our spontaneous desire has diminished, that our overall desire is diminished, that we're low desire. And we need to find new ways to really make the most of responsive desire, create time, prioritize sexual connection in our relationship because it brings something powerful and meaningful. But we believe we're broken instead because we don't have spontaneous desire. And the belief that you're broken just hits the brakes and makes it even more difficult to access desire.
Though I agree with what you said, I will say to you the reason why sex breaks down is because people become to each other a pain in the ass. Lack of respect, lack of playfulness, lack of intimacy, too much anger, too much talk about just the functional things in life. Did you take out the garbage? Did you pay the bills? You know, there should be a time that if you're going to be intimate, shut everything down and play. Okay, and you can't be disrespectful to someone and angry with someone and put them down and not treat them as if they are, you know, that they're meaningful and special to you and expect sex to continue. Now, you don't have to lie to your wife and say, you know what, you're the most beautiful woman in the world and she's 79 and has 3 teeth. You don't have to lie about that. But what you can say is, you know what? You know what? You know, I am so glad that I'm with you and I wouldn't trade you for anyone in the world. And you do it for me. I mean, if that's what you really do mean. But sex breaks down because people don't treat each other right. That's the bottom line.
I'm a big fan of the research of John Gottman has been at the University of University of Washington in Seattle, I think, for a long time. And his four horsemen of the relationship apocalypse are contempt, above all, criticism, defensiveness, and stonewalling. And the opposite of all that, when you boil it down, is just being nice to each other, being friendly, being able to make a joke out of your disagreements in a friendly kind of way. Just being nice and playful and recognizing that you have a connection that is more powerful than just who took out the trash and who did the last load of laundry.
Absolutely. And John hit it on the head. There's probably more to it. But you know what? There's no substitute for being genuinely nice and loving and caring and not think that goes within dating and not within marriage. You know what? It is more important in marriage, and it's more important as marriage comes along and kids come along and bills really come along, that the playfulness and the intimacy and the support and the love is even greater. Okay, the more the pressure, the more the play, and that's going to work.
Yes, can I? I mean, yes, how nerdy can I be? Can I talk about rat brain research?
You could talk about whatever you want.
I love the rat brain research. Okay, so in the middle of the emotional brain, there's a thing called the nucleus accumbens, and when you zap the front of a rat's nucleus accumbens, it exhibits approach behaviors. Ooh, what's that? It sniffs and moves forward and is curious and exploring. And when you zap the back of the nucleus accumbens, it goes, what the hell is that? Avoidance behavior. But when you put that rat in, I call it a rat spa. It's quiet and dark and it smells like home and the rat is just very at peace and happy. You zap the front of the nucleus accumbens, you get the same, ooh, what's that? Approach behavior. But then you zap the back of the nucleus accumbens and this time you get, ooh, what's that? In a calm, relaxed, happy state of mind, pretty much anything will be approached with curiosity and interest and playfulness.
So now, Emily, I want you to go from the rat to John. What should John do, okay, in order to make what you just said, that the rat is probably having a good time. But what would he do in order to get that same response from his lover?
Tell me.
So whatever helps to turn off the brakes. So what are the things that are causing your partner to be stressed out, exhausted, overwhelmed? Because the final stage of the rat research is if we put the rat in a noisy, brightly lit, overwhelming, horrible place, a really stressed out state of mind. When they zap the front of the nucleus accumbens, you get, what the hell is that? You get the avoidance. So when you're stressed out, pretty much everything, even stuff that would usually be approached with curiosity and playfulness, in a stressed out state of mind, everything gets interpreted as a potential threat. So you have to reduce the stressy state of mind, whatever it is that's activating that.
Do you think that food and alcohol help or hurt the sexual, you know, the sexual play?
I think it depends. I think there are adaptive and maladaptive ways to use both. So to take food for an example, the maladaptive way to use food is when you're feeling stressed out, exhausted, overwhelmed, you just shovel food into your face as a way to numb out. Ditto with alcohol. But if the way you're using food, you come home, you've had a stressed out, horrible kind of day, and you and your partner get together and you cook dinner together and you feed each other the strawberries you were going to save for dessert, and you really enjoy the experience, that can help.
Love it.
Sounds good to me.
I love it. And I think, by the way, everyone should realize this, that alcohol has a different effect on everyone. If alcohol doesn't agree with you, then it's not a good idea to use it. And some people drink, they get really happy and playful, and others get nasty and kind of picky. If you are the one who gets nasty and picky, don't drink. Eat a cookie.
In general.
Or eat a carrot.
The client notes that we would give people at the Kinsey Institute Sexual Health Clinic in their instructions of how to go about doing the sensate focus exercises included have a glass of wine or two if you like. And the reason that's there is because a small dose of alcohol can be disinhibiting. So all those, the self-monitoring thoughts and the self-critical thoughts and the cultural noise, it just turns down the volume, having literally one or two drinks for some people. But anything beyond that just starts to turn off your sensitivity, and reduced sensitivity is not what you want when it comes to a satisfying sexual event.
You know what? Agree. Everyone should hear that because it's true. Now, I have this saying that I tell all my clients, that all rejection is self-rejection, okay? Which means this. I shave my head, so I'm bald. Now, if you say, my God, you know, you're bald and you're 15 pounds overweight, which I am, you know what? I don't care. You're telling me it's the truth. So if I'm going to get rejected, it's only because I'm going to pick on myself and make that mean something to me. And what happens with women and with people is they give away their power to others, so others tell them if they're good enough. And I would suggest that everyone hearing this program, that you don't give away your power to anyone, that you really make a commitment to love yourself and to be the best self you could be for yourself. Whatever you like, you like. I don't like skinny men, okay? Meaning I think a guy should have, you know, some meat on him. And I don't particularly like, you know, overly skinny women. Meaning everyone has their preference. And realize that your preference doesn't necessarily mean it's better. It means that what works for you. But self-love is so essential to great intimacy, wouldn't you say?
I would say more specifically that it's self-compassion, which is totally related to self-love. So the metaphor that I use in the book is this garden metaphor, that on the day you're born, you're given this plot of rich and fertile land that is your brain and your body, and your family of origin and your culture of origin start to plant ideas about sex and love and bodies and trust, and they tend the garden for you and they teach you to tend the garden, and you get into adolescence and you take over responsibility for that garden. And you may find that your family and your culture have planted some really beautiful, healthy things that you want to help nourish and thrive. And you may find that your family and your culture have planted some really toxic crap, and you now have the responsibility of digging that stuff out. And body self-criticism, for example, is one of the most invasive weeds that a lot of us find has been planted in our gardens that we can't. And so many of us, we hold on to the idea that we have to criticize ourselves and beat ourselves up in order to because otherwise we'll become complacent and lazy. And if we don't strive really hard to change ourselves, then we will never fully deserve to be loved as human beings. And so we beat ourselves up because when we whip ourselves, the whip is our hope that we could one day deserve to be fully loved as human beings. And that is so deeply ingrained that it sounds, you know, reasonable or sane, and it's not. Because what actually happens if you put down the whip and stop beating yourself up, if you give up on self-criticism? When you stop beating yourself up, you begin to heal, and that's when you really start to grow.
Emily, great advice. Now, I'm gonna give a few pointers that I would tell everyone they should look out for when they start to choose who they want to really be intimate with and grow with. One, like the way they smell. And I don't mean after the shower. I mean they're just their body scent. Okay? Meaning if you don't like the person's actual smell, that's not really good. Two, make sure that you really connect when you kiss. You know, kissing is such a telltale sign as to where intimacy is going to go. Three, if you can't be playful and you can't laugh and you can't and you're not keeping score and there are no holes barred, no rules, except that if something's uncomfortable, you tell the person. And five, to always, always introduce something new and create some danger and adventure and fun in your life so you always reinvent the whole sexual experience. So those are my five things. Tell me what you think.
I think those are, I would put a caveat on that last one, that when you're feeling, there are times when your life doesn't really accommodate play and adventure just because life gets in the way, you're stressed out, you're exhausted. And in that state of mind, what you really need is comfort and familiarity and affection. So allow adventure to come at the times when adventure fits into your life and allow comfort and security and reassurance and connection in a sort of really like calm, gentle, soothing way when that's what life calls for.
So changing the subject, how do you know when a woman is really horny or when she's faking it?
Mm-hmm.
Was that good for you?
Busted.
So there are, if you don't trust your partner, there's something else happening in the relationship.
It may not be trusting the partner. Maybe the partner sometimes is like really tired and doesn't want to say no and wants to kind of get it over with quick. And, you know, she fakes it, not because she doesn't love you, but she doesn't want to turn you down. And just
in fact, because she does love you.
Right. But are there some telltale signs in the body, in the vagina, in the clitoris, in the face, that, you know, this person really isn't having a good time other than they're throwing up on the side? Or they're on their, you know, they're checking their email. Other than the obvious things, what else is there?
So if you really want to boil it down to physiological signs that a person's body is experiencing escalating sexual tension, you want to look for waves of muscle contractions through the hips, abdomen, buttocks, and thighs. So at high levels of arousal, it'll often be quite subtle, but sometimes it's very obvious the person's body is bowing and arching. When you see that happening and feel it happening in their body, these waves of muscle contractions, that's pretty definite.
I love the scientist in you. You know, you just nail it. You know, you just nail it. So let me ask you a question.
I would say that there is something valuable in...
Now, are you married?
Yeah, I am.
You are. Okay. And you're married for how long?
Almost 3 years now.
3 years. Could you ever see yourself cheating on your husband?
No.
Now, tell me why.
Okay, so the sexual response mechanism is a combination of the sexual accelerator and the brakes. And the brakes responds to all the potential threats in the environment. And for me, the idea of cheating would hurt him so much that it just keeps the brakes on. And I would never be able to do something that I know would hurt him so much.
You know what? Again, I love your answer. I love your answer. At the end of the day, part of being civilized is giving a damn and caring about what the people you love. And realize whether you do it in front of them or behind their back, it still affects them. People have an intuitive sense. Women in particular, but both men and women. So you know what? You know, just for another notch in your belt for the next morning to say, what did I do? If you love this person and you're going to commit to them, you know, monogamy is the best.
For some people, monogamy is the best. For some people, monogamy doesn't work that well. Whatever works
for
people.
If it doesn't, if monogamy doesn't work, my answer to that is then you just talk to your partner and say, listen, this relationship is going to change, break up, or we make new rules, which is all well and good. Just talk about it. Don't lie about it.
It's the honesty that matters most of all. As if you're making agreements with each other about how you're each going to behave, you have to honor those agreements.
Right. I personally don't think that most people have the maturity to either bring it up, okay, because they feel that if they told their wife, you know what, I am no longer just interested in you, that would go over well, or with the husband as well. Yeah, even worse with men, because, you know, I think men have more of the macho issue. But I do think that honesty is the best way, you know, the absolute best way to go.
You know? Yes.
So tell me, out of all your studies, what was the most interesting thing that you learned that most people don't know?
Oh, there are so many things that were really, really fascinating. I could talk about the orgasm surprising thing or the arousal surprising thing.
Do both. Go ahead. Go for it.
All right. So for me, a surprising thing about orgasm is that I ended up not being able to use the consensus definition from the community of sex researchers. The consensus definition is that orgasm is a peak of sexual pleasure accompanied by rhythmic contractions of the pubococcygeal muscle. And it turns out, first of all, that there's evidence of orgasm without rhythmic contractions of the PC muscle. There's evidence of rhythmic contractions of the PC muscle without orgasm. And certainly some orgasms are a peak of sexual pleasure, but there are some orgasms that are just sort of meh, and there are some orgasms that feel outright terrible. So a woman whose body responds reflexively to sex when it's non-consensual does not experience a peak of sexual pleasure in that context. So I had to use a definition of orgasm that goes all the way back to Masters and Johnson and Kinsey in 1953, describing it as the spontaneous release of sexual tension. Without any reference to specific body parts or to a specific experience, just this vague, generic, spontaneous release of sexual tension. It surprised me that I had to go back that far to find a definition that really accounted for all the things that orgasm can be.
53 was a good year for scotch and for sex. Okay, I wanted to know that. Last question that I'm going to ask you, because you've been an amazing, amazing interviewer, is tell us about the truth or the myth of female ejaculation.
Oh, so some women do ejaculate. We're very, as a culture, we're very confused about it. I went into a college residence hall and they had a box of anonymous questions waiting for me. So I dumped out all the questions and I'm sorting through them. So in one hand, I have the question, how do I learn to squirt? And in the other hand, I have the question, how do I stop squirting? Which it pretty much sums it up. We don't know why some women do and some women don't. We don't know why some women do. I have a friend who started ejaculating after she crossed into menopause. She had never ejaculated before, and all of a sudden she's ejaculating a quarter of a cup of fluid with every orgasm. I have a friend in her 20s who just started ejaculating with her new partner, and she tries really hard not to, because she experiences it as interrupting and reducing the quality of her orgasm. When it happens, the reason for it probably is pressure on the urethral sponge, which is the female equivalent of the prostate. And the prostate, as I'm sure you know, produces about half the volume of ejaculatory fluid. So it turns out in some women, in some contexts, that gland is still producing some fluid. And it can be expelled around orgasm.
Perfect answer. Perfect. Make perfect sense. I will tell you this from, again, all my experience, men get freaked out. Yeah, there are some men. There are some men that actually, you know, it's very cool, and they almost feel like they hit the ball out of the park, and
right.
It's something to do with, you know, how great a lover they are. But sometimes it just freaks them the hell out, and the only question they're thinking is, who's going to clean up this crap, you know? But having said that, I think that the body itself is a continuing unfolding mystery. But I so much appreciated, you know, not only the science you brought it, you know, to this discussion, but just the fun and practical way in which you did it. Emily, you are a terrific host. No, I'm the host. I'm a terrific host.
You're a terrific guest.
Am I a great host?
You're a great host.
Thank you, Emily.
I did actually have a lot of fun.
Hey, Emily, before you go, can I field you one more question? Don't know if it's going to make the show or not.
Okay.
My question is, talk to me about edging. What do you think about it? Have you heard that? I'm sure you've heard that in your research before. But
edge play around orgasm?
Yes. I'm curious to know what your thoughts on that.
I have the second appendix in the book is about extended orgasm, which is basically edge play. So when you slow down the process of approaching orgasm, you can expand the experience of orgasm itself. So you get up to a pretty high level of arousal, you let the arousal dissipate. You get up to an even higher level of arousal, you let the arousal dissipate. You get up higher and closer, and you can eventually let yourself hover right at the edge of orgasm and have it sustain there for sort of as long as you want to. This originates as a meditation practice in tantric yoga, actually, but can be used for erotic purposes also. It takes practice. It's, I would say, the sexual equivalent, if just having an orgasm is like your 20-minute, 4 days a week jogging for exercise, extended orgasm and edging is like running a marathon.
John is
totally
really happy right now. And the last question, because this is, again, one of the things people don't talk about, is there such a thing, you know, as injaculation, where the man is actually having an orgasm, but nothing is coming out. It is going back inside.
Yeah. You just, so the muscle that you squeeze to stop yourself from urinating, that's the PC muscle. So you train that muscle to be really, really strong, and you lock it down right before orgasm, and it blocks the ejaculate from coming out. It just gets reabsorbed into your body. And that way you can sustain an erection. When you don't ejaculate, you don't lose your erection, because the refractory period is caused by ejaculation, not orgasm.
Emily, you're terrific. And I appreciate the show, and I appreciate you, and you're terrific, girl.
Thanks very much.
Have a great day.
Thanks, too.
Sam. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to once again really thank Emily Nagoski for coming onto our show. She was amazing. Now, pick up a copy of her book, Come As You Are, on Amazon.com. And while you're doing nothing, check out her website at thedirtynormal.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I do executive life coaching. I do neuroplasticity. I've been doing it for 40 years. There's no problem that I cannot make go away. But now I want you to check out our other episodes on GluckRadio.com and on our YouTube channel by searching for Errol Gluck. Also, visit my website, GluckSolutions.com, to learn more about clinical hypnosis and executive life coaching. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Get there out on Twitter. Also, visit my website, www.glucksolutions.com, to learn more about clinical hypnosis and executive life coaching, erectile dysfunction, sexual dysfunction, or just how to make your sex life amazing is one of my many specialties. So, thanks for listening. Till next time.